Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Well, welcome to the most beautiful city in the world, Houston, Texas. And you can look out through my window here and see that the sun just gone down here. Not too much traffic out there in the Texas Medical Center. But it's just great to have you with us tonight. And I tell you what, tonight is another one of those nights that I think it's a money-back guarantee, even though you don't pay for this. It's all free. I think it's really going to be interesting to you, informational to you. And when we talk about trauma-informed systems, trauma-informed care. And I think in the last year or two, I think before that, it wasn't even a phrase, but all of a sudden they created that to kind of give us an indication of what's happening in our world, where we need to be aware of what other people have experienced. So tonight's guest is just going to be tremendous in that. And I feel like I have a brand new friend in Kansas, and we just met not too long ago at a conference. But I spent yesterday speaking in front of a lot of people up in the northern part of Texas, driving several hours away, and with the Texas teachers, and we had just a great time, and I enjoyed them. And if they're on the program tonight listening for the first time, welcome, and thank you for being so caring and loving at the conference yesterday with the Texas teachers, and I appreciate your kindness. And anything I can ever do for you, let me know, and I'll be there in your corner, I promise. If you want to get involved in the conversation tonight, there's two ways to do it. I have my son in Seattle in the U.S. Army. He's up there running the Facebook account, and it is the Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page, and I'm looking at it right now. And yes, we are absolutely live because I see my face on there, too. And you can actually just comment through there, and Curtis may comment back to you. But most importantly, he will pass that comment on to us with me and our guest. Or you can just simply call the wonderful people at BBS radio station at toll free 888-627-6008. Tonight, we have Dr. David Stevens, and he is what we consider a lifelong student. I thought I was a lifelong student, but I think he's got me beat. He studied at, listen to this, Harvard. that already automatically takes everything I've done out the world, because that overtakes it. University of Southern California, Cal State Fullerton, Oregon State University, Chapman University, Trinity College, and Saddleback College, and all over that 28-year teaching career that has included teaching fifth grade, high school math, college math, education teacher preparation, and graduate level neuroscience. Now we're getting deep. He is now the associate professor and the director of Tabor College's Master of Education in Neuroscience and Trauma. And he's committed to training and impacting professionals across all kinds of different disciplines where trauma-responsive care is necessary and nowadays almost mandated for helping victims of trauma become resilient, happy, and productive. And it's my pleasure to introduce to you and welcome my friend, David Stevens. Dr. Stevens, can you hear me tonight?
I can hear you well. Thank you.
Hey, and you have a good radio voice. You have that nice, calming voice.
I think it's my microphone. I have a good microphone that makes me sound better than I really sound in real life.
So tell me what it is that you do for us lame folk that really don't understand anything that I just said. What is it that you really are passionate about and do for a living with those students at Hebrew University?
Well, before we start, can I say something about the way we met real quick? I'll take 1 minute.
Yes.
Because I knew within 5 seconds that you and I were going to hit it off and be friends. And here's how I knew we would be friends. We were at the Creating Trauma Sensitive Schools conference in Houston.
Yes.
Put on by the Attachment and Trauma Network. And you were sitting over at a round table over by the window overlooking the park. And I just wanted to introduce myself real quick before I went to hear you speak. Because you were doing a about an hour long lecture at the conference, yeah. And I saw you sitting there. I thought, okay, I'm gonna go interrupt him real quick and just say hello. But you dropped everything, put your stuff down, closed your book, closed your notes, and gave me your full attention, and looked like you were genuinely excited to see me.
Well, I was
and know me and get to know somebody new. And I thought, you know what, I love this guy. And then we sat there and talked for 20 minutes. So I interrupted all of your prep time for your little talk that you were going to do. And I felt kind of bad, but at the same time, I love people like that. And I need to be more like that with my students when they interrupt me right before class, just to drop everything and make people more important than my work. So I really appreciate that about you. That was amazing. So
there was an immediate connection. It's like, wait, the world that you're in, the world that I am, and it kind of completes each other and works well together. And it was right. Just like, wait, I'm fascinated with what you do. And it was a great meeting, and I'm looking forward to what the years are going to bring down the road with us.
Absolutely. Well, to explain what I do.
Yeah.
So I direct a program here at Tabor College, which is a Master of Education in Neuroscience and Trauma. And it's something that I have been passionate about for about the last 12 years. And the idea came to me back, oh gosh, I would say probably even about 15 years ago. I was teaching at Pepperdine University, and I realized that teacher training doesn't touch on the cognitive sciences and the neuroscience and all of the, you know, the basic structures of cognition. We basically just teach methods. And so that's kind of where I started getting a little bit frustrated with the way we were training teachers, is we were just kind of putting methods into place without really understanding why methods worked. And so that I went back to do postdoc work at Harvard just to study neuroscience and how the brain really works. And I developed such a passion for it that I had this idea for teacher training and for professional development that started with teaching how a normal brain functions, how it really functions best, then introducing slowly what happens when things go awry, such as trauma, mm-hmm. then advancing into behavior analysis and recognizing behaviors in young people who have suffered from trauma so that we can create safe environments. And it's all going to come back to safety. And I have a feeling we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Yes.
Because really, what it all comes down to is how do we create safe environments for all children, especially for kids who suffer from either abuse, neglect, or even acute stress. So that's kind of where it all came out of. And slowly, as I developed this program in my head, it just seems like every place that I was teaching at the time, they ran into financial issues so that we couldn't start new programs. But then when I was teaching at Azusa Pacific University, I had actually reached out to Tabor College and found out that they were actually looking to start a Master of Education program. And that excited me. And so long story short, here I am. They gave me the green light. I told some of the leaders in our admin team about my idea for this program. They loved it. They loved the mission. They loved that it served all students, especially students of trauma, and they gave me the green light and said, you can do whatever you want with this, and you can hire whomever you want to make this program successful. And I have created a dream team of 9 faculty that is amazing. I've got people working for me that I'm learning for every time I talk to them. They're just, the feedback we're getting from our students is so fun because they are being transformed, not only as teachers, but as humans. We've got police officers, we've got social workers, we've got parents who adopt, we've got parents who are foster parents. We've got this group of students who was just eating this stuff up, and they all came here to be transformed so they can go transform others. And it's now, really exciting.
There's not that many colleges that offer this program, correct? I mean, I'm aware of one that I'm on the board for at Columbia College, but how many other master's degree programs in this area are there that you know of offhand? Well,
I would say that like ours, I would say zero. And the reason you said
nine professors is like, whoa, that's major. Compared to even what we're doing in Columbia, that's major. And I would think that it's a notch above the type of training and education that we provide even there. So you may be the only one really that's doing it the right way.
Well, that's kind of what I told leadership, as I said that if we're going to do this right, then we have to have the right people teaching, and I have to surround myself with the best people possible. So for example, with our, towards the end of the program, to have behavior analysis classes, I wanted a board certified professional, not only designing the class, but teaching it. So we have a board certified behavior analyst who is helping a therapist develop the classes, and they teach it together. And it's just, it's been amazing. We have Ken Baugh, who is actually a neurotheologian who helped me develop the spiritual development, the personal development, which is the backbone of the program.
I've heard of him.
Yeah, he was out in Southern California. He recently moved to Tennessee, and he was a pastor of a large church in Southern California and another church in Virginia. And now he's decided to, and he has his own ministry as well now. And now he's teaching for us. But I've been really blessed to have the freedom to bring on such amazing people to teach in this program. And they don't do it for the money. They do it because they love the vision and the mission of the program. And they're here to change lives. And it's really fun to watch.
Our listening audience not only consists of medical doctors and social workers and things like that, but we have a huge population of teachers that listen to the program. Now, who would this certification, diploma, degree, this master's degree, who would it really be for? You mentioned police officers, first responders, things of that order. Who's it really designed for ultimately, and who could benefit from it? Anybody? Would this be something that a teacher would want to get into to get more education on their realm?
Absolutely. I would say that anybody who deals with any human being who has suffered from trauma can benefit from this program. And here's why I say this. You know, it's a master of education, so we actually draw a lot of teachers. And I'll talk a little bit more about why this is so important in the classroom, but we really we cater to everybody, including officers. We have a police officer in the program right now who just had a conversation with me this week about what he's doing for his research. And he said one of the biggest issues that he has is in officer training, they are trained to go to a scene where something has happened, and they are to ask, tell, make. And they are supposed to remember those three words in those situations, because if first they ask somebody to do something, if they don't, then they tell them to do something. And if they still don't, they make them do it. And so through this program, he's coming to the tail end of this program. And what he's realizing is that is the worst way to deal with a traumatic situation, when you're coming into a scene where people are redlining and their nervous systems are on overload. And so he's going to develop a training to help officers learn how to actually go into a scene, work with people, talk to people, and kind of collaborate on a solution to bringing them down so that they can avoid any type of force.
And so is it more like evaluating, seeing, being aware of what is needed, that person at that situation? Is that more of a different approach than what, hey, do this, do this, do this?
Yeah, because we're in the business of reacting to behaviors in such a way that it's not trauma, it's not just being trauma informed, but it's being trauma responsive, so that you know how to read a situation and then respond appropriately, which actually takes practice, and every situation is different. A lot of people will say, hey, what should I do in this situation? What should I do in this? And I'm like, there's no anecdote. There's not a Band-Aid to put on these situations.
It's liquid. It's
right. It's always different, and you always have to be able to read a situation, and you just have to really be empathetic and work on your feet.
So when you started getting into this field, where in the world? I mean, I just can't imagine sitting there in my recliner saying, you know, neuroscience, that's what I want to get involved with. That's not something that I could probably guess 500 different topics. Why did you fall in love with that topic? And where did you see that maybe people were seeing it wrong? And I like the way you approach it, because it's very easy to understand when it sometimes can be overcomplicated.
I think I fell in love with neuroscience back in the early 90s as a fifth grade teacher.
Wow, because fifth grade.
It was early in my teaching career when I realized that my own teacher training did not prepare me to work with certain kinds of students that just didn't fit the norm. They just didn't know how to play school. And so I started just kind of studying on my own and just reading a lot of books. I just couldn't get enough. And the more I learned, the more I realized that my classroom, in fact, most classrooms are not built, they're not designed for the kids who have no attention span, no ability to sit still in their seats. Suffering trauma actually triggers their neural systems in a lot different way than the average kid. And so developing a place where they can feel safe and not always be triggered was something that was just kind of an aha to me. And I thought, why is this not part of our teacher training? Why didn't
deep into this, because this is very important. I want to hear everything you know about this.
Yeah, that was the key, I think, to my success, because what I started doing is completely changing the structure of my room so that all kids felt safe first. Because if they didn't feel safe, then they can't learn. You can't learn in an environment that's safe. We are built for safety and we are built for survival. And if we are not in situations where we are constantly feeling safe, comfortable, we can't take in new information and learn, because we're always on the guard, and it doesn't take much to trigger a student who has an unsafe home. So creating a safe environment, that just became the most important thing. In fact, if I could read something from Bessel van der Kolk, this is actually really important. It actually it deals just with this right here.
Is this from The Body Keeps the Score? Or
yes.
Is this
yes. Okay. And most of your listeners probably have read this, but this is actually really key for teachers, because as most people know, when information comes in, when we sense something, if we're in a classroom, it could be just the prosody of the teacher's voice, the tone of the teacher's voice. It comes in and the thalamus, our thalamus is really the control center that sends out the information to other areas of the brain, and it happens really fast. So if I sense my teacher's voice or anything that seems unsafe in the class, it goes straight to the amygdala, and the amygdala makes some things happen really fast before the rest of my brain has a chance to react to anything, which the hypothalamus sends information to the hippocampus, and all of a sudden stress hormones are going crazy.
Wow.
So what happens to these kids is it just could be a look I give them, and I can trigger stress hormones in such a way that puts them on defense, and suddenly they're not safe. And after all of this happens, then it makes it to the anterior cingulate and the prefrontal cortex. But that doesn't happen until after my body has already reacted. These students react before they even have a chance to think about it. Then we have to figure out how to calm them down. So we need to create atmospheres in our classroom so that that doesn't even happen, so that they don't get triggered so quickly, because if they're not safe and if they're triggered, there's no learning that's going to happen. They're gone. They're in survival mode because they're built for survival.
Right.
So one of the things that I found is that even with fifth graders, they have to be taught not just to tolerate each other, not just to tolerate me, but to learn how to love the differences of other people. So whether it's differences in looks, color, speech, thinking patterns, if they can learn to love other people's differences as strengths they don't have, we can create little people that can feel safe in a classroom that will actually gain skills that will help them later on in life. And even with fifth graders, I used, you know, psychologists use that little trick with in marriage counseling, where if I'm holding the pencil, I'm speaking, and you can't speak until I hand you the pencil and repeat back to me what I just said. Fifth grade boys are the worst at this, especially fifth grade boys who are bullies are the worst at this. And so I put them in situations in math where they would have to debate and they would have to argue. And if the girl had the pencil, she would explain her point of view, how she felt about something, what her thoughts were on whatever they're working on. And then the boys would always be interrupting. And I always have to explain to the boys, as males, we have a really hard time hearing anything after the first point that a girl says, because that's the way we are as boys. So if she's making 3 points, most boys are already making their argument after the first point. So point two, three, four, forget them. So what happens is the girls will make their point, hand the pencil to the boy. The boy will actually make his counter argument, and she'll say, that's not even close to what I said. And so she'll do it again, and it takes two or three times. And finally the boy will say, oh, that's we're on the same page. That's what I was thinking too, but it's just that they don't know how to communicate. And so just using little tricks like that, helping kids at that age start to see eye to eye and appreciate the differences in the way we think, create safe environments because they're not feeling like they're always on guard and that everyone's against them. But those are just little tiny things that we do.
There are
students who have suffered from trauma, we have to be thinking about everything from low rumbling sounds in the classroom that trigger the middle ear to lighting. Even lighting can trigger a nervous system. Wow. And so this is where it gets really tricky when you're training teachers, because, you know, some teachers will say, oh yeah, I dim the lighting and I make it really soft in the classroom, which isn't safe to the students that need to be stimulated with bright lights. And so there's a balance, and there's always every situation requires studying it, figuring it out, talking to the students and learning who they are, how they learn, what's comfortable. And then usually you have to change the environment throughout the day.
Wow. Tell you what, we're going to drill a little bit more deeper into that because I'm fascinated with this. And I just was speaking about this yesterday with a whole bunch of teachers. And I think I probably told them some things wrong that you're correcting me on without knowing that. But we're going to take a break right now, 888-627-6008. And I want to find out more about how to create that environment. And I want to throw out a couple things about what I told them yesterday to see what you think about it. But if you want to get involved, 888-627-6008. We'll be right back with more with Dr. David Stevens. Be right back. Wow. Good stuff. Finally coming very soon will be the release of my second book in the three-part trilogy, Overcoming the Darkness, The Roadmap to Hope. Now, this book will be an in-depth look at the many different facets and emotions that a person goes through when they're experiencing anxiety and trauma in their life, and they're simply searching for hope. And an exciting addition to this book will be a companion journal guide that will come along with it. Also, there's going to be something that I'm very excited about, the youth version of this book called When Dark Clouds Come, The Roadmap to Hope. And it's going to be an excellent tool and guide for teenagers dealing with stress in their lives. So stay tuned for the release date coming very, very soon for these exciting new resources. Now back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams on the BBS Radio Network. All right, welcome back. Dr. Stevens, do you feel that in my dedication of the book that's coming out in a couple of weeks for teenagers, I apologize to that generation because I think we dropped the ball on our kids. Do you feel that way in our world right now as not only teachers, but as parents, as communities, as churches, as, you know, have we kind of just... with all the things that's happening in the world, have we let them down and we need to embrace them again?
Yeah, I do. I agree with you. I don't know if so much if I feel like we dropped the ball, but I feel like the world has changed so quickly and in ways that are detrimental that we haven't been quick enough to react. Yeah. I really feel like, well, I feel like schools are so far behind in creating safe places for kids that now once the pandemic hit, it just made things worse. You know, it just created even more problems and more issues.
Did it reveal to us just how off we were, unprepared we were technology wise of anything that could happen? Because it blindsided a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, it did. I think one of the things that we're finding is, you know, during the pandemic, how do we make technology personal? How do we make it loving? How do we make it caring when we're so isolated and looking at each other through screens?
Yeah.
Because I think that telling kids go off on your own, do your own stuff, and then come back and meet for a couple minutes, I don't think that that works. I think that we needed to find ways to have classes fully online, fully engaged, as close to the real in-person classes as possible. But I just think teachers weren't prepared for it. We weren't ready for it. It just caught everybody off guard.
I guess that's a positive that can come out from all of this, that while we have excelled leaps and bounds in the last year or two with technology and those approaches. Back to that fifth grade classroom. What's some other things that you did different in your classroom that made kids feel safe? I mentioned yesterday something about everyone likes surprises. And then I went, oh, no, they don't. Students that have been traumatized hate change, hate surprises. Am I wrong in that?
I did a little bit. So some kids like surprises and they like to keep it, you know, keep on their toes. But you know what? If you create an environment that is completely safe, then surprises are okay. And one of the most important things we can do is create an atmosphere where mistakes are not just okay, they're mandatory. Oh. And so here's one of the things that I think is really, really important. This was key to my success as a teacher. In fact, I think that the reason I had such high math scores in the state of California was because of this one thing. When students made a mistake in my class, it was an opportunity to celebrate the fact that we're going to watch them learn something new right in front of everybody. And so if I called on somebody that didn't know the answer, we celebrated it. We said, cool, I can't wait to see what you do to figure this out. This is going to be kind of fun. Wow. And it takes all the pressure off. If you can just change the atmosphere so that mistakes are not wrong, mistakes aren't a bad thing, which is kind of the way our school system has always worked. You know, when teachers call on students, whenever we ask questions, we're looking for correct answers. I would always look for wrong answers so we could celebrate the fact that there's something that people don't know in this class so that we can watch them learn it right here before us. And that's a very different way of looking at learning because...
What a good approach though. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. What Einstein was the one who said, if you're not making mistakes, you're not trying anything new. And that's the way, that should be our whole mentality about school. Try new things, make mistakes, learn from your mistakes and push on. And so that was a big deal. That actually changed the atmosphere. But on top of that, I think that we need innovative ways of looking at the way we play school, such as grading. You know, we all set the bar and say, here's what you have to do to get an A. Well, that's not fair to if I'm teaching 10th grade algebra and I've got a kid in my class who's at a fifth grade level, that's not fair to him if I teach him 10th grade level algebra because he's going to be stigmatized and be stuck at that fifth grade level forever because he's never going to bridge that gap. But if I can teach something just above his threshold of understanding so that he cannot, so that it's a struggle for him, but he can figure it out on his own, well, something goes off in his head where he did it by himself and he figures it out and he gets excited and all of a sudden, hey, I can do this stuff. And after a few weeks, so his A is not way up here with the rest of the students. His A is down here at his level. And so it makes it attainable for him.
And but if he's building confidence, right? It's a cognitive response of, hey, I met a goal. I could never do that, but I can do this.
And he's not just building confidence, he's building a foundation of knowledge that he never had before because he never learned it when he was in fifth grade. Now he's learning it now. Let him learn it at his level. And what happens is he starts to skyrocket in his knowledge and he starts catching up to grade level because he's enjoying it. He's getting excited about the fact that he can learn this stuff. And I mean, I tell my students this story all the time because I had this kid named Miguel. My first year teaching algebra in high school, he was sitting in the front row. And after my first week of teaching him some stuff, I gave a quiz and he got 9 out of 10 incorrect. And so I said, Miguel, I'm really sorry. I don't know what I did wrong. I don't know how I didn't help you understand this stuff. And he thought that I was ridiculing him. He actually turned, he blushed a little bit. He was embarrassed. And I said, no, Miguel, seriously, I'll figure out something over the weekend. And then I said, wait a second, go talk to Cynthia back in the back corner. She understands this really well. Go talk to her and then come back and see if you can explain it to me. He comes back 2 minutes later. He said, Mr. Stevens, all you had to do was show me this, this, and this. And I was like, Cynthia, you are brilliant. You should be teaching this class. And then Miguel. And so I said, Miguel, go change your grade in the grade book, which was sitting on my desk over in the corner. And he said, to what? I said, go give yourself an A. And he goes, first A ever. And I was like, that's all it took. I mean, he walked across the whole room, like with his fist clenched because it was his first A he ever got in math. And I was like, that changed my whole philosophy of grading forever. Because if I could teach everybody just above their zone of proximal development, their threshold of understanding, and get them there, something happens when somebody makes a discovery on their own. And it's very similar to taking cocaine because discovery on your own is, it produces a chemical reaction with dopamine and other chemicals that's very similar to the rush you get from drugs, low dose. But if I can put students in a situation where they can make discoveries and those chemicals flow in their head because they did it on their own, I can get them addicted to learning. That dawned on me after studying neuroscience and putting kids in these situations. I realized, oh my gosh, as a teacher, why am I doing so much talking? Why am I lecturing so much when they have a 7-minute attention span? I should be giving them projects and group work and things to let them explore, discover, figure this stuff out so I can watch them get excited and get addicted to that feeling that comes from learning something on your own.
That's absolutely fascinating. You've got me on the edge of my seat. I'm not even a teacher, but it's like, this is unbelievable. How many teachers do you think fall into that category of needing to be reminded this is what they're there for?
Yeah, I think we all do. I've been doing this for, you know, 26 years now, and I still find myself lecturing too much to college students. And I have to step back and say, why am I talking so much? And I'll always say, just remind me not to talk so much so that I can give you guys stuff to work on. But it's the way we've all played school. It's the way we've all been trained. We've all gotten through the system. So we're products of our environment. And it's hard to break out of that. And we perpetuate the problem with our teacher training, you know, direct instruction. We teach everyone how to teach. When really, I think if all teachers just sat back and coached a little bit more and didn't tell people so much what to do, our students would flourish. If you think about it, most people don't like being told what to do. Most people like to explore and have fun and figure stuff out. But it's got to be caught at a young age. Because I think that by the time they get to high school, they've been trained how to play school, that they're doing it for the grade. And a lot of students can even get enjoyment from the grade rather than from the knowledge. And we've moved away from the joy that comes from intelligence, knowledge, critical thinking, becoming better humans, to just getting the grades so that we can progress to the next stage.
What's your opinion of how we can bring together the vast chasms that are difference between some schools and those schools that's in marginalized communities? How can we level that out to where we're teaching and it's an equality, equity across the board for every student, not just the ones that's in the charter schools and the better schools, but the ones that are in those under economic class schools? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think my main opinion on is that in those schools that are marginalized, in those schools that are in some of these poverty-stricken areas, I think that it comes down to the teacher knowing their students to the point that they can empathize and love like crazy. And understand that you know, we have to actually step outside of the game and look back in on who they are as people and meet them where they are. But the problem is we actually are so, we just have these stringent rules, guidelines, and a lot of this comes from accreditation down. You know, we've got state and national accreditation telling us what we have to teach and what students have to know at certain points. But I think that you could go into any school and a teacher who loves their kids to death can step back and say, you know what, I'm going to do what's best for you. And I'm going to do what's best for you without getting caught is really what it comes down to, because accreditation makes it really difficult to do that. So if I've got a fifth grader who reads at a first grade level, I need to be teaching him at a first grade reading level to slowly bring him or her up to a second grade level, and forget about my testing and all of the things I'm told that I have to be doing, because it's just the system is broken. And a lot of teachers leave the profession because they get so frustrated with the system. But I think that you just have to have that mentality of, I'm going to love these kids to death. I'm going to do what's best for my kids. And I'm not going to worry about all that other stuff.
Yeah.
And that's hard for professionals to do. It's hard for teachers to do because we worry about our jobs and we worry about principals coming down on us and the district coming down on us. But I've always said, you know what? As soon as the district tells me I can't do what I'm doing in the classroom, or as soon as the principal tells me I can't do what I'm doing in the classroom, I'm going to find a different profession because I love what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And if I don't love it, and if I can't love kids to death, then I'll find another way to do it.
If you got a call from President Biden tomorrow and said, I want to select you as the new secretary of our Department of Education, what would be the first thing that you would say needs to be changed in the way we do business compared to, excuse me, what's going on out in the other countries that sometimes seems to have an advantage over us and then sometimes don't? But what would be one of those things like, oh, yeah, now we can make a difference. Now I can choose to, what would you do?
I got to be careful how I answer this. Because this is being recorded, right? And yes, we're live. So
we can edit it out. But it's already live around the world. But hey, go ahead.
I think that... I don't know that it should be centralized. I don't know that the government should be in charge of how districts do things, because every district is different. Every community is different. New York does things differently than California. The Midwest does things different than all of these other areas. So I really think that we need to decentralize how we tell districts they're going to do things and what needs to be learned at certain grade levels. I think we need to step back and look at everything. You know, Ken Robinson, I don't know if you've ever heard him speak, but he'll be the first one to say that we need new paradigms. So I think one of the first things I would do is bring Ken Robinson on and say, Ken, let's design something totally different for education in America. And we would be looking at things like age. Why do kids have to go into kindergarten at age 5? Who decided that age 5 is the right time to go into school when some kids can't read yet, don't even know their alphabet, and some kids are reading at a second grade level? Those are the things we just need to step back and look at and say, why are we making these kids stay? It's like an assembly line. Our school system was designed for the industrial age, and we are so far behind actually looking at the way we do things and fixing it and changing it for today's day and age. I think we need to look at everything. Look at the way we grade. Look at the way we assign homework. I mean, a lot of teachers assign homework just because they got homework, and themselves as kids, they don't know why they give homework. Does it reinforce learning? Well, if you look at all the research, most research says that homework doesn't reinforce learning, that it just exhausts kids. So, and I'm not saying homework's bad. Yeah. And parents, especially today. I'm not saying homework is bad. I'm just saying that every teacher should examine why they do what they do and then ask, is this beneficial? Because as a fifth grade teacher, I thought, I've got these kids under my roof for 6 hours a day. if I can't get everything done in 6 hours, that's information overload already. Why would I give them more stuff to take home? I want them to have dinner with their families, play sports, dance, do whatever they do outside of school, because I can get it. It just don't waste time in school. And I told them, I said, we're just going to, every minute of this day, we're going to do something so that you don't have to take anything home. And the students got excited about that.
I'm sure. Tell you what, we're going to take our second break. Okay. On the other side of this break is I love having this conversation with you. This is wonderful. I want to find out what your opinion is about the increase, at least from my area that I've noticed, of homeschooling.
Oh, yeah.
And what is the impact of that? And what do you think the opinion is of faith-based church schooling compared to public schooling? I want to dig into your brain on the other side of this. 888-627-6008. And if you have a comment, jump on the Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page. And we'll be right back for our last segment with Dr. David Stevens. Be with us.
From HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Wow, I'm looking at my text. I tell you what, we have several of the teachers that was in those sessions yesterday listening tonight. So welcome, Texas teachers. And I think it's wonderful, David, that you're with us, that with all the experience that you have as not only a lifelong student, but a teacher that has probably second to none. And now you are involved in being an associate professor at a master's degree program in neuroscience at Tabor College. What is your opinion on public school compared to homeschooling now? Because I keep hearing that more and more, well, I'll just homeschool my child now because of what, you know, the pandemic has done. And then faith-based schools. But let's just talk about the homeschooling issue. Is that something to be alarmed about, or is that something that we should encourage more of?
I would say that is a very personal and individual decision based on what's going on in your local district. And I'll give you an example. In California, we decided we were going to, one of the reasons we decided to get out of California and start seeking positions outside of California was because they were going to start teaching gender identification and sex ed starting in kindergarten. And I said that's too much for me. I don't want my, because we have a 4-year-old daughter and I didn't want her learning that stuff from somebody else besides her family. And so Kansas schools are very different than they are in California. And I love the public school system here. I feel completely comfortable. My wife's a teacher in public schools here, and I'm 100% comfortable with my daughter going to school in public school here. And I wasn't in California. And I think if we had stayed there, I probably would have homeschooled my daughter because I was teaching in a master's and graduate program at Azusa Pacific. So I could teach at night and I could have my daughter home and homeschool. And I probably would have. Because my older kids went through private Christian high schools, and then my daughter wanted to go to public high school. So I've had my kids in everything. We've got 5 kids. So my kids have been through the gamut of education. Yeah. And I really think that is a personal choice, and it comes down to your faith beliefs, your personal beliefs, and what you're comfortable with. And sometimes it comes down to what's going on at your homeschool. It might not even be a district issue or a state issue. It might just be how comfortable you are, because I think parents have the right to know exactly what their kids are learning. And that is my personal opinion. And all these things going on politically right now are driving me nuts, where people feel like parents need to keep their noses out of their kids' education. Like, what in the world is going on right now?
What caused that? When did we step over the line to where we wasn't allowed or encouraged to attend? I was a president of the school board for years. And the only time a parent showed up is when we were getting ready to dismiss their student or do some kind of discipline on a student. But most of the time they trusted us to make sure everything was going well.
Yeah.
But now it's like, don't go. You're not welcome.
Yeah. I don't know what is going on right now. It seems like it's gotten progressively worse in the last 5 years. It seems like about 5 years ago, you would hear stories about this happening in certain areas of the country. But, you know, just recently, it seems like it's happening quite a bit, where parents are being asked to step back and their voice is being taken away. And parents are even getting in trouble for voicing their opinions at board meetings.
Wow.
And it's just been kind of sad to watch, because I think it is a sad commentary on what's happening in public education right now.
Could it be the fact that what you talked about earlier about a fifth grade classroom not being safe in environment? Are we crossing the line in that realm with public school of bringing in political issues, bringing in sexual identities, and all of this stuff that is so complicated now?
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest problem, is we're politicizing the classroom, that you know, teachers are bringing their political ideas and ideals into the classroom, and they're not stepping back. They expect conservative teachers not to bring their faith in the class, but then most of the school boards are pretty liberal, and most of the most teachers in public education throughout the country are pretty liberal. But I just think that that's kind of the beast that we're dealing with, is we just have to keep politics out of the classroom and teach. I mean, you can teach social skills and some of the important things that are outside of academics without being political. And I just don't think we're very good at it in public education.
When you do your particular expertise now with what you're doing at Tabor, and I encourage everybody. So there's somebody now that if they're listening in Maine, they can enroll in this course, right?
Absolutely.
And, okay, because it's all online and in that kind of situation, they don't have to be on campus?
No, it's 100% online. The only thing they do have to be on campus for is orientation, because we bring everybody together to make sure that everyone's comfortable with each other, that we know each other very well, because the content, the material we cover in this program is pretty intense, and it gets pretty personal, and there is a personal development aspect to it. We are actually asking people to come be transformed so you can go out and transform others. So you don't just come here for knowledge. You come here to actually practice in some personal improvement and development. And you learn a lot about yourself in this program. And so I would say that most of the people in this program would tell you that they have been changed as humans, not just in their knowledge base as teachers, social workers, policemen, but they have become different people, and they're going to leave here different human beings. And that's what's so exciting about this program, is that we really want you to come here with this complete 100% willingness to be transformed and changed. Because my motto is just like everybody else: do unto yourself before you do unto others. You have to be healthy before you can go out and really transform other humans.
And you show them how to do this in this course.
We go through, it's a process. We start slow and we go for 1.2 years. We start heavy duty in the summer. The first summer is very intensive. Then we take it easy in the fall and the spring for teachers, because teachers need to be able to teach. They need to be able to get their classrooms ready. So we take it pretty easy in the fall and the spring, and then we follow up with another intensive summer. So it's done really in one school year, but it's more like 1.2. But anybody can do it. And it's for anybody that really wants to have the knowledge to not just be trauma-informed, but trauma-responsive. So that
okay,
you
so
can,
after they complete this and they get this master's degree, what would you recommend your students to go into? What would be the best benefit of them if they have this extra expertise to say, hey, wait, this is going to enrich this area probably more powerfully than any other area? What would those few areas be besides police officer, which is unbelievably awesome?
Yeah, what I'm seeing right now are teachers that want to develop their own trainings and actually bring it back to their own districts. So I've got three or four teachers that are right now with their research teaching what they're learning in our program to faculty on their staff.
So and they're spreading it once they get back.
They are. So I've got a couple of students who are working as a team. They developed a training starting back in August, and once a month they teach, they do trainings for faculty on their staff. I've got another teacher who's doing the same thing. She's developing a training that's going to be a little more intensive on a weekend. So we've just got people that are so on fire for this stuff that they realize this was not a part of our training in our profession. What can I do now to bring this back and change the field? And so for me, I feel like this is awesome because it's exponential. Everything we're doing in this program is exponential because they're going out there and they're going to change their worlds. And I've seen a couple of programs online that I think are kind of doing similar stuff. And I think the people eventually start stealing some of our ideas. And I'm like, great. I hope everybody steals our ideas and goes and does the same thing in their programs because there is such a need. It is really sad that we attract so many people. I mean, the program, we didn't think that this program would ever have this much attention. So that in that sense, it's kind of sad that there's such a need. I mean, it's good for us at Tabor, but I feel like, wow, there is such a need that can't be met just by us. We couldn't do it. So I hope that this becomes exponential and it just spreads out and that other people start doing the same things. I hope that other colleges will take some of our ideas and run with it because they'll see the same thing. They'll see that they're transforming people, which actually goes in and it actually infects schools with really great stuff to help teachers understand how to create safe environments where kids who don't have safe homes can come in and be safe and actually start to develop as not just intellectually, but as humans.
Well, that's powerful. Now, David, I don't really have a minute or two and I don't want to get cut off because they go to another live program right after this. If somebody wants to get in touch with you about something specific or just in with the program, what's the best contact information and what's the best way for them to be able to do that before we get cut off? Provide that for our listeners right now.
So the first thing they could do is just Google Tabor College Master of Education Neuroscience Trauma. If you just Google Tabor Neuroscience and Trauma, it'll be one of the first things that come up. You can also just email me directly at davidstevens@tabor.edu. And it's David Stevens, one word, at Tabor, TABOR.edu. And I can set anybody in the right direction and put them in contact with our recruiters. And we've got our next cohort coming up May 14th. So there's still time for people to apply and we're being selective. So got to get you.
How many do you allow in the program every year?
Well, right now, I didn't want to go above 45 students in our first cohort, and I'm probably going to try to cut it off at about 60 for this second cohort coming up because it's very personal. We meet every Thursday night via Zoom. So it's not just people that aren't just set on their own. It's not self-paced. Faculty meet with the students every Thursday night. And so we do a lot of interactive discussions and conversations and we break out into small groups. So it's more like a face-to-face classroom than most online programs. And that's because of the material. We have to have discussions.
And what's the first, if I enroll, what's one of the first courses or two that you're going to throw me in?
So you jump right into it. You start with fundamentals of neuroscience and cognitive psychology. And then we go straight into the research courses. And then we go into cognitive neuroscience. And after that, we start moving into more of the behavior analysis, trauma-informed courses. And then we end with the research and the trauma-informed learning communities.
Fantastic. Well, I'll tell you what, David, I knew this hour would just fly by. I have enjoyed this so much, just having a conversation with you. And I know our listeners, too, we're having all kinds of different comments. And my phone is vibrating a lot right now. which is good, with people that say, hey, this is awesome. So thank you so much for being with us. And if there's ever anything that I can do or we can do, let me know. And David, I will be in your corner. I promise you that. And hopefully we'll meet up again in another conference here pretty darn quick.
Yeah. Well, even if we don't, let's find a way to meet up. It's okay, great being friends.
That'd be great. Thank you so much for being with us, Doctor. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Okay. I hope people reach out to you, and I hope they get on Tabor and at least look at what's going on to find out if they want to get involved, because I think it's a great program.
I love it. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. As we do every week here from Houston, I always like to just let you know in the program in the same way, no matter what kind of experience that you've had in the past, whether it was last week or 20, 30, 40 years ago, no matter what you're dealing with right now, and no matter what you're going to be facing tomorrow, as long as you have breath, I just want to encourage you and promise you there's always hope. There's always hope. And with what I've seen with Dr. Stevens and his world and his beliefs and his lifestyle and his values, if you want to have a good quality master's degree program, I encourage you to at least check that out and give them a chance. Thank you for joining us tonight. Join us right here next week, live from Houston, Texas, for another edition of Breaking the Silence. God bless you. Have an awesome, awesome Passion Week as we enter into that week of Easter. God bless. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1 for the next episode of Breaking the Silence.